Today, I want to talk about the economics of higher education, particularly college education. For a lot of people who don't think much about government support for college education is a motherhood issue. We just think, well, the more government supports higher education, the better it is. Education is good. Government ought to support education. It just, if you don't think about it beyond that level, it just seems to make sense that the more we spend on higher education, the better off we are. The key economic issues don't necessarily come out that way if you analyze it economically. The key issues there are to look at public versus private benefits. There's the challenge of trying to measure value added. And then finally, there's the issue of assessing the impact of government subsidies. Do they help primarily affluent people or do they help poor people? And do the subsidies provide a benefit to the people who are paying for the subsidies, namely the taxpayers? For further reading on this topic, I've put up links to a few things. One is the a chapter from my book, and then two other things. One's an essay, and the other is a links to ultimately to an article in the Washington Post that raised this question of what exactly do subsidies for higher education do? The columnist in the Post noticed that we have a lot of government subsidies for education, healthcare, and housing. And what are the things where the prices have been going through the roof over the past several years? Healthcare, education, and housing. He says, is that a coincidence? Probably not. That if you throw more government money at something, you end up seeing a lot of price increases. And so that makes you wonder, is that the best approach? Okay, so first let's talk about just some general trends in education. First of all, we have some favorable indicators. One is strong foreign demand for U.S. education. That is, a lot of foreign students want to come to the United States to study at our colleges and universities. So you'll sometimes see statistics that seem to say that our primary school education isn't good. They'll compare the math knowledge or the geography knowledge of our high school students with those of other countries, and those comparisons are often unfavorable. But as far as college and graduate school are concerned, the market test of where people want to study, the United States seems to win. That is, people from other countries seem to want to come here. So that's sort of a favorable indicator. Another favorable indicator is the salary premium for college graduates, which keeps growing. That is, the difference between the average salaries earned by college students versus students who haven't graduated college keeps going up. And it keeps going up in the face of increases in supplies of college graduates. So if you thought if the proportion of people getting a college degree were staying the same or falling, so that college degrees were as scarce or scarcer than they were years ago, then the increase in salaries for college graduates would be less dramatic. But what makes it particularly dramatic is the fact that the percentage of people getting a college education keeps rising. So even as the supply is rising, the relative price is rising more, which says that in some sense the salary premium is growing even faster than the observed numbers indicate because there are more people taking advantage of it. On the other hand, there are disturbing indicators. One is that the real cost of tuition has nearly doubled in the past 30 years. By the real cost, I mean adjusted for inflation. That is, if you compare, let's say the amount of other goods and services you would have had to give up to get a year's tuition 30 years ago versus today, the amount of other goods and services that you have to give up in order to pay for a year's tuition has doubled in the past 30 years. So that's what I mean by the real cost of tuition nearly doubling. Another random disturbing indicator, binge drinking, the Thursday through Saturday party phenomenon. And that's just symbolic of general concern that at least adults have that college time isn't just spent learning, and that there's a lot of time wasted and a lot of behavior that at best is people having a good time, and at worst is people just kind of going a little berserk. Another disturbing indicator is grade inflation. More generally, you'll see professors complain that the quality of the preparation of students coming into college is weak, that they're seeing bad writing, poor math skills, unwillingness to do lots of reading, and yet they feel obliged to give high grades. And so there's that indicator, that question about college education. Another disturbing indicator is colleges playing games with admissions. So a college will try to encourage lots of applicants so that it can reject a lot of them, and because that rejection rate makes them look more selective. So what that gets back to is this issue of measuring value added. If you could really measure how good a college was, then indicators like the percentage of students that it rejects would mean nothing, because you would instead directly measure the value added. You wouldn't be using vague signals like that. So this ability to play games with admissions and play games to try to increase their rankings in the like U.S. News and World Report rankings and so on, those are indications that real value added is difficult to measure, and so colleges will do other things to substitute for that. Here's another thing to think about. Suppose your tuition is $24,000 a year, and you take 8 courses a year. Then you can think of that as the cost of the course is roughly $3,000. And suppose you're taught, as you're being taught in this class, by an adjunct faculty member who's paid $3,000 a course. If you take 90 students in the class and you multiply that by the $3,000 each that they are in effect paying for the course, then I'm bringing in $270,000 in revenue with only $3,000 in cost. What in the world is going on there? Where's the rest of that money going? Beyond that, we have alumni donations, which are over and above the tuition. You have state subsidies, which again are over and above the tuition. The federal government, in effect, is subsidizing education by making donations for colleges tax deductible. And I think I read somewhere that, something on the order of half of all the tax deductible contributions in the United States go to colleges and universities, as opposed to going to, say, charities that directly affect poor people. So there's a lot of money floating into that system. Again, if you look at the direct labor cost, it's a little there's you wonder where is all that money going. Another point that I would make is that it's pretty clear that over the past 30 years, as these real tuition has increased, as real tuition costs have increased, that private benefits have increased. That is, the benefits that are not social benefits. A social benefit to college, that is a benefit of your getting educated that benefits me, is things like you're becoming a better citizen. That's a social benefit. If you have a great time in college, that doesn't benefit me. It doesn't make me worse off, but it's not a benefit that I should be willing to pay for. If you earn a higher salary in the future because you go to college, that benefits you, it doesn't particularly benefit me. So the social benefit is just the benefit that someone else gets from your college education. And the point is that it's pretty clear that private benefits have increased. Colleges have become a much more pleasant place in which to study. The facilities have gotten better. You see nice gyms to exercise in. The food's gotten better. Just the overall quality of life of a college student is much better than it was 30 years ago. In addition, the private benefits in terms of the salary premium of college graduates versus non-college graduates, that salary premium has gone up. So that's another private benefit, but it's not clear at all whether the social benefits have gone up. So we've had this big tuition increase, which in some ways can be justified from the private benefit point of view, maybe not so much from the public benefit point of view. Another point of concern is that professor salaries are really high relative to opportunity costs. That is, these people are earning more as professors than they could earn in any other occupation. And that suggests that they're earning what economists call rent. That is a profit over and above what it takes to bring them into that industry. And another sign of that is that there's chronic excess supply for faculty positions. That there are many more people who would like to be tenured professors than there are tenured positions available, particularly in the humanities like English or literature. Another sign that money may be floating into sort of excess rents or profits for individuals is that administrations have become really bloated. There used to be far fewer administrators per student 30 years ago than there are today. All sorts of deans have sprouted throughout the university system. So let's take a step back and say, all right, the government does subsidize colleges and universities. You have states establishing schools like the University of Maryland. You have all sorts of government programs to subsidize tuitions for students, and there are tax credits to get higher education and so on. So what is the goal of these subsidies? In theory, the goal ought to be to obtain the public benefits of having a college-educated population. That is, the benefit that I get from you being a better citizen, maybe a more informed voter, what have you. So there ought to be so one goal of subsidies ought to be to raise public benefits. Another goal ought to be to increase opportunity for the poor. We want our society to be one where people have the opportunity to move up, and if college is very difficult to afford for poor students, then that will make it difficult for them to move up. So that's another rationale for subsidies. But then what we turn around and say, well, what is the impact of these subsidies? And it seems to be in part it's raising the consumption value of school. Like I take the nicer holding pen is my shortcut for describing that if you think of college as in part a holding pen for people for 4 years, it's become a lot nicer than it was 30 years ago. And then I spoke earlier about the higher rents for professors, that professors are earning a lot more relative to really what you would have to pay them to get them to come to class. An alternative approach to doing the subsidy would be to provide vouchers directly to poor students. Presumably, then, poor students would take that money and apply it very carefully, they might choose a college that maybe does not provide as nice facilities, but provides good value for the money for them. But that brings up, and that would probably be the most efficient solution in terms of achieving the goals of subsidies while having less effect on just sort of raising the consumption value of education and raising the rents for professors. You see, if what happens in a with a state subsidized school, let's say like the University of Maryland or University of Virginia, if what goes on is that most of the students who attend those schools are relatively affluent, then what you have are poor taxpayers in the state, in effect subsidizing the affluent to enjoy a good life in college and also to eventually earn a higher salary. So you're in effect subsidizing inequality. You're engaging in what's considered a regressive sort of tax and subsidy, where you're taxing poor people to subsidize the affluent. If you gave vouchers directly to poor students instead of to an institution like the University of Maryland or University of Virginia, then the money would be going directly to poor students, and so you're getting a less of a subsidy to the affluent and more of a subsidy to people with low income, which is really what you'd like to do. So that's an advantage of a voucher proposal. With any approach to dealing with public education, there are two challenges, or any approach to dealing with public support for higher education. I keep falling back on this issue of measuring value added, because if you give a voucher to a student, what you want that student to do is intelligently shop around for the best value in education. But if you don't have good measures of value added, then it's difficult for the students to shop intelligently. Not having good measures of value added makes it difficult to know to what extent professors are being overpaid, or to what extent these bloated administrators are a problem, or it could be that the growth in administrators is actually a good thing. Exactly. Maybe all these deans are making college education better. You don't know, because it's very difficult to measure value added in college. It's very difficult to take a controlled experiment where you say, all right, let's put these students through this process. Let's put a very similar set of students through a different process and see which ones come out knowing more. We just don't do that kind of value added measuring much in education. And because we don't do that much, a lot of the assessments people make about what is a good college, what is an effective education, are just stabs in the dark. So it's very hard to know the real economic value of different colleges and comparing them. Finally, there's the challenge of measuring the public benefit. What is the public benefit of having people go to college? And we can measure a salary premium, although even that does not necessarily measure value added. The fact that college graduates earn 50% more than high school graduates could mean well, to some extent, that means that the more talented people are going to college in the first place. The right way to measure the salary premium, the value-added way to measure the salary premium, would be to take two identical sets of students and take the ones who don't that are similar in terms of other characteristics but don't go to college versus those that do, and measure the salary differential. And chances are, if you did it that way, it wouldn't be as large as this 50% figure. But more importantly is, what is the public benefit? Because the salary differential is a private benefit. It's a benefit that you can take advantage of as a college graduate. The consumption value of college, the fact that it's a nice lifestyle, that's a private benefit. So what is the public benefit, and how do you measure that? How do you measure the extent to which universities make people into better citizens, and what that value of being better citizens is to society? And I think implicitly we way overestimate the public benefit of education. I think the case for government subsidies for higher education, at least the subsidies in the format and the amounts that we have now, is really tenuous. That it's, I really doubt that we're getting anywhere near the public benefit that that would match the public cost. I think we've come closer to matching public benefit to public cost if we were to withdraw all the other subsidies and replace them with something like a voucher that goes directly to low-income students. So again, this is a very counterintuitive given what people tend to grow up thinking, that higher education is such a wonderful thing. It's a motherhood issue. It should keep getting, the more money that goes into higher education, the better. When you unpack the economics of that, again, it's not so clear. And that's, I think, the main lesson is that it's not that clear, and that probably the key to figuring out the whole issue is to come back and come up with ways of truly measuring the value added of education and separating out that value added between private benefits and public benefits.